Hi, I'm Dr. Robin Koslowitz, clinical psychologist, parenting educator, and post-traumatic parent. Welcome to the Post-Traumatic Parenting Podcast, where we learn to provide our children with a healthy childhood, even if ours was anything but. Or maybe we had a wonderful childhood, but recent events in our lives have left us reeling. Let's face it, after 2020, we're all post-traumatic parents now. Welcome. Hi, everybody. Welcome to a very exciting episode of the Post-Traumatic Parenting Podcast. Today, I am thrilled to be talking to Rosalyn Wiseman. She is the author of Queen Bees and Wannabes, the book that Mean Girls was based on. Actually, a book that was super influential to me when I started working and doing the anti-bullying workshops in schools, because it was the first book that really pinpointed a type of bullying that I had experienced my whole life and had no idea that there was a name for it. And when I met Queen Bees and Wannabes, when I read that book, which I read like I think 5 minutes after it came out, it filled in so many missing pieces for me. And one thing I want to say to post-traumatic parents is a lot of times those of us who are experiencing trauma at home end up targets for this kind of relational aggression bullying because our brains are not ready to do the invisible rules of being a girl because we're too busy staying alive. And that's why this particular project, like even before Mean Girls came out, just that book alone, I think Mean Girls brought this to huge attention, but that book alone, giving a voice to what relational aggression is, was personally very impactful for me. So for those of you who like to like read all my backlist stuff, definitely check out that book. She's also the co-founder of Cultures of Dignity, and we're going to hear a little bit about what that organization does. So super excited to talk to Rosalyn today. And some of you sent me some questions for her, so we're going to get into those. So Rosalyn, tell me, you know, it's been many years since Queen Bees and Wannabes came out. Tell me a little bit about, you know, where the inspiration for that book came from, how you named this invisible phenomenon, because I think that was amazing.
Well, thank you. So I was teaching what we now call social emotional learning in schools all over the Washington, D.C. area. And I was teaching girls, but also listening to girls about what they were describing in their lives and the conflicts they got into. And I wrote Queen Bees and Wannabes because I saw a whole social landscape of girls and girls' friendships that I thought were important for us to talk about and take seriously and have more insight into about how it impacts girls as they get older. And so that was really the motivation for what became Queen Bees and Wannabes.
I think it's amazing that you named something so invisible. Because it's true. This is how girls bully. Girls don't walk over to other girls and punch them in the face. I love that idea that, you know, girls can be as mean as they want as long as they pretend to be nice. I think girls give themselves that permission a lot. And for post-traumatic people especially, and I don't know if this is consistent with your experience, that can feel so threatening because it's like, what memo did I miss?
Like you can't see the signs until it's like right up in your face and you feel like you can't do anything about it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think in general, what I was trying to do, and I've continued to do throughout my career, is be able to put words to feelings that people have, like you were saying in the intro about, you know, how do we describe the world that is around us when it can be either confusing or it can feel like it's so normal that you shouldn't do anything about it, but it really feels bad. And so how do I get the words to be able to say that? And my career has really been about putting words to feelings and to being able to say to people, just because it's common doesn't make it right, certainly. And if that means, and certainly that's the case, if dignity is being taken away from people. And that's really important for girls, for all young people to really know, is that just because it's common doesn't make it right, and that your dignity is not negotiable.
I think that's so true. And I think dignity is such an important construct to think about, because I think it's one of the things that trauma takes away from us. Because when we're focused on survival, we're not focused on dignity. Can you talk a little bit more about how you see dignity?
Sure. So I've been thinking about these issues, like you just described, again, like, you know, my whole career in all different kinds of ways. And dignity, the definition of it is that it's just someone's essential worth, that you are given dignity. And the world is filled, though, with people who are going to try and take it away and try and take away that feeling that you have the right to this essential worth. And children are very vulnerable to having people in positions of power do that to them. And the thing that's so traumatizing for people is that, and one of the mechanisms that where trauma, I think it's so pernicious, it's so difficult, is that we're taught to respect our elders, and we're taught to respect them even when they don't treat us with dignity. And my work has been about separating those two words. That respect, and the definition of it, is admiring someone based on their actions. So you really do need to earn someone's respect. When I walk into a class, when I work working with young people, I feel that I'm their teacher, or I'm an adult that they can count on, that they can, that cares about them. But I have to prove that to them, because the world is filled with adults who don't do that. And as long as we talk about having to respect your elders no matter what, it's absolutely a way that adults who are abusive can use respect to get away with taking away the dignity of someone else. So for me, I want young people to use the word respect. I want them to use it, but I want them to be able to be empowered to say to themselves and therefore other people, I don't have to respect the actions of a person who's in a position of respect or authority in my life if they are going to seek out taking away the dignity of someone else.
I love that. I think that you're right, that healthy parenting really does give a child that sense of dignity. Like, I am a human with intrinsic self-worth, and I deserve to be treated as such. Even if I'm a second grader, I don't deserve to be denigrated just because I'm little. And it's true that for sure trauma just takes away that own inherent sense of like, wait a minute, that's not okay. And I guess you're right that dignity and respect can be so confusing, because there is a social skill involved in showing someone in a position of power the respect of their office simply because you're going to get squashed if you don't, right? It's the smarter, more strategic thing to do. But then at the same token, there has to be a balance of, do I keep my self-respect while I do that?
Exactly. One of the things that I know from young people who have people in positions of power abusing that power is that they feel that if they have to show respect to somebody that they don't respect because of this, that they somehow feel complicit. They somehow feel that they have contributed to their own denigration. And it is so important to say to young people that just what you said, sometimes you have no choice but to show respect to somebody that you don't, because they are abusing power, because they can make your life so difficult. You know, I have to say, like, I've had kids who come up to me and said, but why should I even treat someone with dignity if they're abusing power? And that's a really, really important conversation to have with a young person. And I would never, ever, or anybody who's suffered abuse, is I would never say to them, well, I know the answer to that question for you. Because I definitely think you don't have to respect somebody who is taking away someone's dignity. But I also know that it can be a matter of life and death to show someone the appearance of respect. And these are really painful and really important topics that I've talked to with young people. And oftentimes I sit and the most important thing I can do is just bear witness to their experience and give them permission to be able to say these words out loud.
Yeah. The question becomes like, what's strategic and what's smart? Like, this is a fight. Is it your fight? Is it your fight right now? You know, because maybe this is your fight 20 years from now, but it's not your fight right now. I can think of a time where I had the opportunity to like sort of go back to someone who treated me very disrespectfully when I was a very young adult and sort of get my own back, sort of say that wasn't okay 20 years ago. But 20 years is a long time to wait for that.
20 years is a long time to wait. And you don't, and young people don't want to hear that in that moment. They understandably have a drive to have whatever that's happening to them, have it acknowledged. And sometimes that's not safe. And sometimes you're also not going to get it. There's a lot of what I'm doing, advice videos for young people, it's or for anybody, it's really about trying to figure out what is the amount of things you can do in a moment to be able to be proud of the way you've handled it, to be able to take the smallest, most meaningful thing that you can do to give yourself dignity and to reaffirm that. And also to be able to say to young people or people with less power, and we also have to keep you safe. And what is the thing that's going to do that? And also, if you speak truth to power, that you cannot have any, especially with your parents too. I just did a video on this first student, is that you can't have any expectations about getting acknowledgement, affirmation. The person in any way says, I see what you're saying, but it doesn't take away from sometimes the value of doing it in the first place.
I have this belief that unspoken words can be toxic. So sometimes I'm going to say the unspoken words. Now the ball's in the other person's court, right? Because there's a difference between getting it said and being heard. I may not be heard. I still have the right to get it said. What happens later, that can be very hard, especially when you're talking to somebody who's been abusive or somebody who's been painful. They're not going to hear it. You're not going to get, you know, especially when we're dealing with narcissism in the family, you're not going to get that narcissistic stepdad to be like, come to think of it, I treated you lousy all those years. That's never, no matter how many words you come up with, that's never going to happen because he has no vested interest in ever seeing it through that viewpoint. You still can get it said.
Exactly. I was just talking to a young woman about this with her father, and that he mocks her all the time. And of course, what happens with young people is that they get more and more upset, understandably so, because they don't feel like they're being listened to. And then the more emotional you get, the more the other person can make fun of you about it or dismiss what you're saying. It's almost like an insurance policy that the person who has power has, is they want you to get upset, because the more upset you get, the more they can dismiss what you're saying. So a lot of what I do is try and have young people, to the best of their ability, manage themselves so that they can have these conversations and have a better chance of being taken seriously. It's one of those things that I so wish that, listening to young people when they've got really painful family experiences, that, you want it to go away so badly if you want to help them. There's this need, real drive to gosh, you hate the kids are going through this. And how do you keep them safe? And also, how do you teach them to appropriately advocate for themselves?
Yeah. And I think you're saying such a subtle distinction, which is your emotions are valid and okay. They're just not helpful right now in this situation, because then you're going to blow up over something silly and then you're going to look completely emotional, because that's what's going to happen, right? You're going to, I'm not going to react. And then, you stub your toe and then everything comes out in one emotional jumble. And then you're too emotional. You're too hysterical. You're too sensitive, basically too female usually. That's usually what those are coded language for. But it comes out that way because, and we're not saying don't feel your emotions, feel your emotions, just feel your emotions when it's safe to do so. Right here in this moment, can we lower that signal so that you can be okay? Because it weakens your case when you're emotional.
Yes. And it's really, really hard. And so young people, everybody needs skills to be able to feel their feelings, process them, articulate them to themselves, think about how they want to articulate them to other people, and then manage their own feelings in response to how other people react to your feelings. That's a lot. It's a lot to ask a person to do.
I wonder, how do you manage that within the family? Meaning you go back to your family of origin and there are those people who communicate in that subtle bullying way, that mocking way. Maybe it's even, grandma. It's somebody who we're going to grandma's house for Thanksgiving dinner, and it's grandma who does the pass the potatoes. Oh, personally, I never eat carbs. Are you sure you want those potatoes? Where it's like, thanks for calling me fat. We know what that was, right? And maybe you want to model handling that properly for your own kids. But at the same token, you want to be respectful, because you're right. Your dignity is not being respected there.
Yeah. So I think I differentiate between two kinds of comments. One is, you have political kinds of conversations where people are bringing things like that up. And in those situations, because it's the same thing, the person who has less power or is seen as being more emotional tries to manage it, but then they get poked at, right, during the conversation until they blow up. So then the person is dismissed and the ideas that they have are dismissed along with that person. And so I think in front of your children, if you hear things like that, under that kind of bucket of like racist or homophobic, whatever discriminatory, nasty things that somebody can say, I think you, what you say is, and you can do this, and I want you to do this in front of your children. You can say, you know, I really, really disagree with you about it, but this isn't the time because, for example, X person put a lot of effort into this meal, and I don't want to affect that or ruin that or whatever the word is you want to use by us having a conversation right now that it's not respectful to this person's work that they put so much time and effort into. But I do want to have the conversation with you. When is a good time for us to do that? That's 2 minutes, maybe a minute. You are handling it respectfully. You're treating yourself and the other person with dignity. Your children are seeing that you're competent, that you can handle these things, and you don't have to win and dominate the conversation in the moment, and that you're being respectful to the person's work that created this family get together, if that's what's happening in front of you.
Right. I feel like you can even do that with the hostess. I really want to focus on this delicious meal you've made and enjoying our family time together, not politics, whatever. I disagree. We can always have a conversation about it later.
Well, actually, I want people, I would say, instead of always, we can always have a conversation about later. I would say, I really do want to have this conversation with you. When would be a good time? Or let's talk later about when a good time is to discuss it. So that you're putting that person on notice that you really do want to have a conversation with them. And it needs to be done in a way that is, frankly, mature, instead of it becoming a power dynamic and a power battle and ruining, and you know, the family dynamics. So, and you absolutely can do that with the host if they're the person who's making these comments, because sometimes the people who's hosting it or whose roof under which you are eating can say, this is my house, I get to do whatever I want, right? I mean, that's a hallmark of these kinds of dynamics. And so you being able to navigate between those dynamics is really important. And for your children to see that, really important. On the other hand, I think there's another sort of set of bucket, you know, kinds of comments of like what you were talking about, where somebody is really rude to you or to rude to another person, like make some kind of snarky comment to another person at the table. And, you know, I think this is really a bystander. We talk to kids a lot about like, don't be a bystander, but we often are bystanders and don't do anything about it. Like our parent goes after one of our siblings and we don't say anything about it. And, you know, people need allies. They really do need allies. And so to be able to say to a parent or to say to somebody who's being unkind, to say like yourself, say, you know, it's really, really hard for me to hear you say that about her. That's not my experience. Or it's really hard for me to hear you say that about her. And I really would prefer that you not. And again, like it's 30 seconds and your kids are seeing that you are speaking out. You're not making some enormous battle with this other person. And the person that's being targeted knows that you've got their back.
I think that that very passive aggressive person is going to double down on what I was just mentioning, that I tried a new diet.
Of course they will. And my response would be, well, that's really not the way that I'm hearing it. I mean, here's the thing. When you're alone, you can say the way that you are speaking to that person or the way you're speaking to me doesn't really come across as if you want me to do better. Or it doesn't come across as you're curious about what I have, what I'm feeling or what I'm thinking or what I'm saying. Is that accurate? And then if they say, no, I'm not really curious, then don't have that conversation because that literally is a waste of time. If they say, yes, but, you know, but I really wasn't, I'm just rotating all this stuff that people say, then it's your opportunity to say, well, the way in which you're coming across to me, that's not the way it's coming across. Do you want to hear about how you think it's coming across? Because really what it comes down to is saying to the person, do you just want to say what you want to say? Or do you want to actually communicate something to me that means something to you? Like you must have a good reason. I don't understand what that is. So asking people questions is literally like an invitation to ask them to self-reflect, which a lot of people can't do or some people cannot do. But at least you're framing the conversation so that the conversation doesn't get out of your, it's a semblance of structure founded on dignity of yourself and the other person.
I love what you're saying because I do think that curiosity is a relationship superpower that for a lot of reasons, traumatized people don't have. Because curiosity feels like I'm opening the door to discomfort, right? Trauma wants to keep our life very small. So if I open the door, who knows what we'll walk through. But inviting their curiosity into the room Like, I'm curious to hear your side. I wonder if you're curious to hear mine. Automatically frames it as this is a relationship. Let's get curious about each other's viewpoints. And I could see how that could really work to have a productive conversation after that. It's true that there will be people who will say, no, I'm not curious about your viewpoint. You're just wrong. But at least then you have clarity. Okay. You're not engaging.
Exactly. And then you can say, like, if you ever change your mind, I would like to have this conversation with you. And then you walk away and it's on your own terms. You're not screaming and crying and getting or whatever it is, the family dynamic from the past that rear themselves up in these situations. When they say no, or they say something like, well, yeah, I am, but, and then they go over, you know, keep going. It's really your time to say, yeah, this conversation actually isn't working for me right now. I do want to have it, but it's not working for me because you're not listening to what I'm saying. And listening is, in my definition, is being prepared to be changed by what you hear. It is not listening for understanding. It is being prepared to be changed by what you hear, which does not mean you have to agree. It means that you walk into a situation with that as an understanding. And then as a byproduct, you might be able to understand somebody better. But when that's not possible, don't waste your time. You have many other people that you can have difficult conversations with. And all of this is practice, especially for people who've gone through really hard times in the past where these kinds of conversations can feel sort of mythologically powerful. The people behind them can feel mythologically powerful, that doing any of this takes away that some of that mythology, some of that, like, I can't speak to this person. I have lost my words. Well, when you walk away on your own terms, having said, this isn't going in a way that's going to be good, but I do want to have it at another time. So you're not walking away for good. You're saying, like, at another time, we can talk about it, but not right now.
And then we don't have to be afraid of it, because the unknown is scarier than the known, I think.
I think so too.
Hi, friends. I'm interrupting this episode to let you know that we now have a post-traumatic parenting YouTube channel. Yeah, that's right. We finally have a YouTube channel. It's for everything that needs a little bit more of a visual component, maybe some pictures, maybe some demonstrations. So what are you waiting for? Head on over to YouTube, search for post-traumatic parenting and subscribe to the channel. Make sure to click the little bell in the bottom of your screen so you never miss a single episode. And please let me know if there are topics you'd like us to cover on the Post-Traumatic Parenting YouTube channel. If you do join the YouTube channel because you heard about it on this podcast, feel free to DM me or mention that in the comments and you will have my undying appreciation. Thank you for listening. And now back to the episode. That is such a subtle distinction. And it's so true that when we open the door to curiosity, you're right. Even if I expand my schema of women raised in the 1950s think this way, I just expanded my box a little bit. Doesn't mean I have to think this way, but I get why you think this way. It makes sense given your upbringing and your childhood and your way of communicating. I now know something.
And I don't have to agree with it, but now I know. Now I have better understanding. Like, right? Like, I try and remember when people do things that I think, why in the world would somebody do X thing? I try and remember in those moments, there must be an understandable reason why they're doing it. And if I understand the reason, then I understand the whole situation better. It does not mean I have to agree. It just means that there must be a good, meaning understandable reason why they're doing something that I think is so completely wrong.
I have this tactic that I sometimes use that I've been told is a passive-aggressive answer to passive-aggressive. I wonder what you think.
Ooh, I want to hear that.
I call it aggressive friendliness. So I'll give you a scenario. My mom is differently abled. She uses a motoric wheelchair. She's also in the beginning stages of dementia, so she's sometimes confused. We had a birthday trip to Build-A-Bear, and it was on one of her good days, and she wanted to go. So we went to Build-A-Bear, very exciting, took the wheelchair van, and something happened. The remote control of her wheelchair jammed with, like, the door of Build-A-Bear, and the wheelchair got stuck in the door. And there was, like, until we figured it out, there was a line of people. So you could imagine the situation gets a little fraught. And, you know, because people are waiting to get into Build-A-Bear. There's overexcited toddlers.
Okay, got it. I was wondering where you were. Okay, got it.
Yeah. So we're at the mall. We're trying to get into Build-A-Bear. The wheelchair jams in the doorway. It turned out the electronic communications were fighting with each other. The fix was turn off the remote control, just push the wheelchair, go to manual mode, push the wheelchair through. But it took me a minute to figure that out.
Of course, because there's so much going on around you, of course.
And I have my own excited toddlers, right? Everybody's, you know, excited and, you know, trying to get in. Then once we get into Build-A-Bear, this one woman just kept speaking loud. We're waiting for that giant wheelchair. oh, honey, I would show you that teddy bear, but that wheelchair is in my way. So I turned around to her with a big smile and I said, isn't it wonderful how nowadays spaces are accessible to people that didn't used to be accessible? We'll move the wheelchair in a minute and then you can have your turn. But right now, it's just a beautiful thing that wheelchairs can get into stores. I was inauthentic in the sense that I wasn't feeling friendly towards this woman. I had many judgment thoughts in my brain in that moment. I also had like a kind of self-conscious preteen with me who was feeling like we're taking up too much attention and space. So I had a lot of like thoughts going on in my head, and also my mom, right? I wanted my mom to feel that she has absolutely as much right as anyone else with two legs that function to be there in that space. And yes, motorized wheelchairs are big. And we will ask for patience as we get the wheelchair to a convenient spot for it to sit, but it's going to take a minute because especially if we're on manual mode, it's a little harder to push. At the same token, I'm not allowing this woman, she was just making loud comment after loud comment after loud comment. I felt like it needed to be addressed, but there was an inauthenticity in my, what I called aggressive friendliness. And when I posted a video about it, someone said, so you're basically being passive aggressive back.
And you're asking me what I think about it?
Yes. Or like, what would be the way to handle that kind of situation?
Well, first, I really respect the fact that you're A, thinking about it and self-reflecting, B, put it out like to get feedback from other people. And now you're asking me about it. So, I mean, I think that that in and of itself is very valuable. And that's what being an adult is having moments where you have a lot of stuff going around. You act in a way that you're thinking, oh, no, wait a minute, why did I do that? Do I need to think about why I did that? Right. I mean, that's what being an adult is, regardless of how old you are. But I also think that, and I love this term aggressive friendliness is that I think women often feel like they have to do that to be able to express their anger, that you have to disguise your anger in friendliness because you're not allowed, you're not supposed to get angry. And I think that's the reason, for example, that you probably did that because it feels too uncomfortable because we have so few role models of, you know, do you get in someone's face and say like, how dare you? Do you see, like, that's the other way, right? Like, how dare you? Do you see my mother? You don't care about like, you know, people in wheelchairs, like that kind of, you could take that route.
Right. Like the whole one day you may be elderly, I need a wheelchair, right? Like,
I hadn't even gotten to that part.
Yeah, that's where I was going. Like, do not shame my mother and my family. Like, disabilities are not something to be ashamed of. You know, that was my sense of anger.
Right. Okay. So there, I think that's really where the truth is, right? Which is disabilities are not something to be ashamed of. And that we all in this world need to do some accommodating for people where it's a little harder to get into a space. And what's strange about the way that a lot of women are raised is that saying the truth about and factual truth about what's happening feels like we don't have the permission to be able to do that. Because that's mean or that's too aggressive. You actually said what I think, and I can imagine, you know, if I was in that situation, my mother has the right to be here. She's in a wheelchair. We are doing a family event that is as meaningful to you as it is to us. And I really appreciate your patience. And so I think that saying what you need and what you want and a little bit of what you're seeing, a little bit, or not, maybe not even that. But I do want you to hear me and saying, I understand where that comes from, of the aggressive friendliness. And I think it's important to be able to recognize where it comes from and say, I actually have the right to be able to say what I need and what I'm seeing and what I want. That's showing up the way that you want to show up as a competent adult person.
Right. Like I could have been more authentic and addressed her directly and said, I apologize for the inconvenience. We do have the right to be here. My mother has the right to enjoy her grandchild's birthday party. I get it. It's uncomfortable. The wheelchair's big. We'll be out of your way in a moment. Like I could have been more authentic.
Yeah. Also, I mean, wow, you just like nailed every single thing that was going on in that situation that I think is, you know, I think that would be really powerful. And can you imagine, that's just what we were talking about a few minutes ago, is that when we get super angry, it enables the person to not take what we're saying seriously. And saying what you just said to someone in that situation, I think is brilliant because the other person has nowhere to go but to have a moment of like, I mean, they look like such an ass if they continue and being rude when you are just literally saying, I acknowledge you have the right to be here. I acknowledge this is frustrating. And this is my family, my mom, right? So I just think that's beautiful. And I would say, you know what? Unfortunately, you're probably going to have another opportunity to use this skill when you go out with your mom, because we're not as thoughtful about people in wheelchairs as we need to be in general. And so you now have an opportunity where you've learned and you can apply it for the future. So you're going to be that much better prepared. And I think what also is really great about what you're saying is that what I'm hearing is the drive that you've got is to be authentic. You want to show up the way you want to show up. And I think that's really, really, that's what our kids need to see. Even when we make mistakes, that's what our kids need to see.
Yeah, I want to be authentic. I also experienced a lot of girl bullying growing up. So I no longer want to swallow my anger and just like sort of pretend, right? So I was trying to like respond because like, nope, you're not going to attack me and my family. Like, this is not okay. But yeah, I was still, maybe it's a higher level, but it's still, there still were elements of like passive aggressive communication in that, in the way, because I didn't really give her, I wasn't curious about her. I was judging her. And therefore I was, you know.
Well, yeah, I don't think you need to be, frankly, let me say, because I'm so glad you said that. I don't think that's a moment of curiosity. You're not going to get into a conversation with a woman at a store who's being rude to your mother about why she's being rude to your mother. That's not a time to be curious. That is a time of saying, this is like, I get it. It's frustrating. I'm sorry this is happening. It's frustrating for us too. My mother has a right to be here. That's actually a moment of being declarative about what you need while you're treating that person with dignity. But you know, I do not think you need to be curious. There are times when getting into conversations with people are very important. There are times when it's inappropriate. There are times when it's not appropriate. And that's a time when it's not appropriate. You need to take care of things. You need to take care of your business in that moment.
I think it's true. Women are sometimes afraid of our anger, and we don't know. And anger just identifies a problem. We don't always know how to identify the problem and just straightforward talk about the problem.
Exactly.
It's interesting because I think in those multi-generational passive-aggressive communication styles that happen, a lot of times when we ask for clarity, people are afraid that that's starting a fight. And I almost feel like that's, you know, you're already in a fight and that other person is sort of winning that fight.
Yeah, I mean, you're in a power dynamic, and people will display their power in various ways. And I think you being able to, what I would call generous authority, you are using your authority for the good of others. And like your description of what you wanted to say to that woman about a minute ago, that is, excuse me, an expression of generous authority. You're expressing your authority for the benefit of your family, your mom, your kids, actually this woman, and everybody in the store. Is you're expressing generous authority. It's super powerful to be able to do that. So you're coming into your power, to use your own word, you're coming into your own power and expressing it authentically. And that's when it would feel solid.
That makes a lot of sense. I think that for so many of us who were traumatized as kids, when other people were picking up some of that social and emotional sort of nuance, if you're so focused on survival in your childhood, you really do miss those memos. And then when we become parents and we're trying to help our kids navigate a social world, but we never really figured the social world out ourselves, it can be doubly threatening because I didn't know how to do this myself when I was in middle school. So I can't really help you do this in middle school unless I first learn it myself.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense.
And, you know, I'm just thinking even like kind of that trope of like from Mean Girls, like on Wednesdays we wear pink. I think for so many people, you know, that's just such a fun meme. The idea is, who doesn't get the memo that on Wednesdays we wear pink, right? The function is not that the group cohesiveness. The function is who's not in the group. There's just so many of those subtle things of the way, it's not only girls, but it's particularly used by females, but the way relational aggression works. We just knew that we never got the memo over and over again growing up. But what's the fix for that to help our kids sort of get the memo?
I mean, Queen Bee is very much is, you know, I wrote that for that reason. And what I do now is young people between the ages of like 12 and 30, basically ask me questions that I then answer on video. And it's a lot of deconstructing, like, here's the memo, basically, of here's what to do. Here's how to read this situation. Here's what your options are. I had a really difficult one that I I have three videos going up next week on this one topic, which was a girl wrote to me who said, I'm in a toxic friendship and I want to get out of that friendship, but that friendship exists in a group and I don't want things to get dramatic and difficult in the group. What do I do? And that is incredibly difficult. And it's the same in a family, right? Like you've got a really difficult relationship with someone in your family. And the family unto itself is a group dynamic, and it's going to respond to, if you put your boundaries down about being in that toxic relationship, or even, and a boundary could be talking about it and just saying like, this is not okay, then the group's going to respond. And to use your words about this, is my job is a lot of like, here's the memo, here it is, like, here's what your choices are. And very few of these memos have like quick fixes that 100% are going to make the problem go away, but they are going to make you feel more informed, and they're going to make you feel, because you feel more informed, you're going to feel that you have more self-agency, you have more power. You can see things coming from, you know, instead of just like hitting you upside the head, you can see stuff coming on the horizon. Like, oh, this situation is happening. It's a little bit far away, but I can see it, and I need to trust myself that I'm seeing it, not that I'm just deciding that, oh, it doesn't matter. And then you try, you know, ignore it and hope for the best. That there are times when you really need to listen to yourself. And it's especially in the moments that you need to listen to yourself is when you are saying to yourself, don't listen. Because really, to go to some of the words you've been talking about, is that when you're saying to yourself, don't listen, that's really about fear. Fear is legitimate. It's an emotion, whatever it is, like that's your feeling. But also you can have very significant reasons for being afraid. But we got to listen to that, so that the more we say, no, don't think about it, don't make too much of it, I think is the moment where you're saying to yourself, why? Why am I so trying so hard to convince myself not to take something seriously? Just for that reason, I should take it seriously.
It's like that willful blindness. I almost feel like for post-traumatic people, when you have so many emotions and life feels so out of control, you don't want to have that difficult conversation, or you might even want to, but like not today. Like, I can't deal with the drama today, this week, this month, but then you'll never deal with it.
Right. And, you know, I have to say what's very humbling is that, you know, I went through some pretty difficult experiences as a young person. That I didn't grow up in a violent home, but I had a really difficult relationship in high school, and that lasted pretty much all of high school. It impacted me greatly through my adult years. And it also gave me an opportunity to really self-reflect on how I wanted to be in the world, so I didn't get myself into another relationship that was similar to that one. And I think the thing that's really humbling, there's many things in life that are really humbling, but you know, as an adult and somebody who does this stuff for a living, does not mean that I'm immune to getting into situations where I don't listen to myself. I've had work relationships where I have not listened, and I should have been listening to what I was saying. So, you know, it's really important to take these moments, like the moment you had about, you know, in the Build-A-Bear, or the moment I'm talking about with somebody that I used to work with, that you really have to listen and say, how do I want to be? And also listen to what you're saying, because you're saying something important. And in my case, even though I really do have a lot of expertise with this, doesn't mean I'm immune to not having the same challenges.
I think there's this distinction where when people say like, trust your gut is either very, very, very right or very, very, very wrong. But either way, it has a lot of information. So we can listen to it. And the information might be, yes, you're correct, gut, this is risky, and I'm going to take the risk. And the information might be, yes, you are correct, gut, so therefore I'm going to change an aspect of a situation. I had that recently with a school where a lot of my gut feelings, I was negotiating a contract with a school, a lot of my gut feelings were, this is not going to work well. Like, this communication style of this school is not going to work with what I can do. I had a lot of, and I, for whatever reason, decided to ignore the warning signs, mostly because money-wise, they were offering more money. And I was like, oh, I was a little blinded by that. It's hard. But I ignored those gut feelings to my detriment. And after I negotiated the contract, I really had to sit down and self-reflect and say, why didn't I just listen to my gut? Not to leave the contract, not to like not work with them, but to put some other safety measures in. And why did I do that? Probably because in that day and in that week, I didn't want to deal with more discomfort because there was other discomfort. which means I need to leave space for discomfort when I'm entering negotiations.
Exactly.
And I think that's one of those, like, you're right. Those are the kind of hard-earned wisdoms that we win from trauma. Like, this is where our suffering can turn into something that we can use because it's the most effective, though most painful teacher.
Absolutely. So that means, by the way, I mean, I would imagine you tell me that, you know, if you have suffered trauma and you are now a parent, that letting your child go through hard times can be so excruciatingly painful and anxiety producing because it's so easy to be hypervigilant and also catastrophize the experiences that your child's going through because it's so easy to think for good reason, right, of like superimposing your experiences and your emotions to that onto your child's experience, which could be very different. You know, children need to know from their parents that they can get through hard times because when a parent says, this is really hard and you can get through it, like, I'm here, I love you, I'm in the background, you can do this. You know, I'm here to support you in the way that, you know, is appropriate as we go through this. But when we catastrophize the problems that our children go through, it really sends this message to our kids that they can't get through it. And that's really not what we want to be doing for our children. So here'd be a good example of, you know, how I think we can be very cruel. Parents can be very cruel to each other about looking at like, well, why are parents so, you know, micromanaging or why did they get so intensely involved in their children's lives? And this is a very good example of I can look at really difficult, quote unquote, crazy situations the parents, you know, are doing. And I can say in a really intolerant way, like, this is ridiculous. The parents are like this, or parents have too much time on their hands, or they're micromanaging. They don't let kids get through their own experiences. And we can be very cruel to other parents about that and not curious about that. And this is a really good example of there must be an understandable reason why this parent is doing that. And if I can figure that out, then I can get a much better sense if I'm actually involved in the problem, that I can get a much better sense of how to handle it. But if I'm not curious about it, if I say, you know, sort of sarcastically say, like, why is that person being like that? Why are they so micromanaging or whatever? That's not a place of curiosity. You're actually making a judgment posed as a question. And I know that it's really important that people are held responsible and accountable for bad behavior, you know, whatever that means in a particular situation. But you can't do it if you can't see why they're doing what they're doing. You can only actually be able to talk to people about the behavior and be able to meet them halfway when we begin to understand what they're going through, which also, you know, doesn't mean we have to put up with it. If you have a parent that's another parent you're working with or you some for some reason are interacting with them, I'm not saying that that's an excuse 100%. What I'm saying is it's really important to understand, like, oh, this is where they're coming from. This is why they're acting this way. So now I understand that so I can take appropriate measures to be able to take care of myself and maybe my child in this situation.
It's very true. I think a lot of post-traumatic people equate discomfort with danger. And we want to protect our kids from danger. We should. We have a drive to protect our kids from danger. And that's true. Discomfort isn't dangerous. A lot of times when I've spoken to parents about some questionable parenting decisions, if you really go what's under that, you get, but then she'll be uncomfortable and then she'll be alone with that discomfort the way I was. She will be uncomfortable, but she's not alone with her discomfort because unlike you, she has you. So she'll be uncomfortable with you, which is how she'll grow and become resilient. So if we can see that, if we can get to that pain that underlies it, when we have the time, the problem is we don't always have the time, but when we have the time, that's the value of psychotherapy where we can like keep unpacking. But in post-traumatic parenting, we have a lot of that problem that you were talking about helicopter parenting or smoothing the path for their child from one of two places. Either I don't have headspace for my child to go through a crisis right now, so I'll smooth her path because I'm still so entangled in my own trauma that I don't have room for it. So if she doesn't like her science teacher and I call the school and yell and I get the science teacher she likes, then I don't have to deal with my kid not wanting to go to school every day. And that's from one place and we can deal with that. And then there are those parents who are like, if my kid's uncomfortable, they'll be traumatized like I was, which is another whole path of post-traumatic parenting. And either one, your kid isn't you though.
Right, exactly.
So you're right that a lot of like contra curiosity, right? That closing down of curiosity comes from, I just don't want to deal with the discomfort of expanding my schema or getting this. Just don't want to. And sometimes you're right, you don't have the bandwidth. Sometimes I don't have the bandwidth on a particular day. I remember saying to my husband at one point when I took a certain contract, just so you know, on that day, like this is how we're handling like supper plans and things like that. Like I am not adding another thing to my plate, right? Like we're ordering in dinner for those 4 weeks that I'm going to be speaking at that school. We are ordering in dinner that night because I need as many little annoyances, like little things off my plate so that I can focus on this. If I take this on, this is the sort of the trade-off that's going to happen simply because I know what I have the bandwidth for and what I don't have the bandwidth for. I was working with a mom and she really didn't have the bandwidth for any sort of like minor stumbles with her kid, like friction because of what she was going through. And the smartest thing we did is we hired a homework teacher. Every day we hired a high school kid to come into the house and do homework with her children so that the evening could just be when she got as much bandwidth. She was going through a really severe trauma at the time and she wanted to make sure her damage wasn't going to damage her kids. So that way she was only doing the connecting fun stuff, cozy stuff with her kids. She's not fighting with the kid about, let's do your math homework. Let's do your math homework. Let's do the math homework. This cute, fun high school kid who has prizes is coming and she's doing that. I wouldn't say to always do that, but in that moment, what do we take off your table? You're ordering in dinner, right? We're not having any stressors because you're right. It's very hard for someone going through an acute trauma to connect with her children because trauma is sort of antithetical to connection and you want to connect to your kids through that. Her husband was very, very ill with a critical illness. So, and the evenings were difficult because her kids were traumatized kids being raised by a traumatized mom while dad is dying. So we're going to take every stressor off your plate. So all you're doing is attachment. Now, if there wasn't dying dad and there wasn't all that other stuff, I might encourage her to let's learn how to have that productive conflict about, yes, you are going to do your homework, right? At a different time. But right now, you can't add one stressor to your plate if you're going to do authentic connection with your kids while your husband's dying. That's the way we're going to make this plan. Because I think you're right. I think it does boil down to like being okay with discomfort, but when we have the bandwidth for it.
Yeah, agreed.
Now that we've had this conversation, if any post-traumatic parents are curious about you and your work, where can they find you? Where can they find your work? What are you working on these days?
Yeah, it's very, very hard. It's so hard to find me. So you just put my name in and everything, you know, pops up. So on every social media platform, except for X, I don't have a media on that. So any advice videos I'm doing are mostly posted on TikTok and then they're posted on Instagram. That's what I'm doing. If you have questions, people can write to me and I can answer the questions that way. I am traveling around the world doing this work. I'll be in Paraguay doing a training in March, and I'll be in Shanghai, China doing a training. And then I'm doing a lot of speeches and all different kinds of things, but somehow related to pretty much everything that we've talked about today.
Amazing. I feel like this is going to be an episode that a lot of post-traumatic parents are going to come back to because this is the real stuff. We always say in post-traumatic parenting that adulting is hard if you never childed. And this is the real adulting. Parenting is adulting on steroids.
No kidding. Regardless of one's experience, right? But yeah, I really appreciate you sharing with me, you know, the lens of the experience of trauma and how it impacts parents. And then the way in which that can be consequential on parenting. So tremendous amounts. We all have complex families. I don't know anybody who doesn't, but there's a certain level of complexity, a certain level of abuse, and a certain level of discomfort that's not okay for people to experience. And when that happens, to be able to get the skills, to be able to manage it for yourself and then have compassion for yourself, so you can get better at bringing in the children that you've brought into this world, or, you know, in whatever capacity you've done that, you've brought into your home. It's really something to be acknowledged and appreciated and respected. I certainly feel that way.
Thank you. It's the book that I was looking for when I became a mom 26 years ago. And I really was looking for how will my PTSD impact my kids? And there was nothing out there. And it took me time to realize that that was actually, like, you know, my whole PhD, that was what I was actually studying. I was studying child development, and I was studying trauma, and I was studying clinical psychology. And I remember feeling very frustrated with myself. Like, a lot of my classmates, especially at NYU, where it's like very focused, they had very super specific like research interests, and mine were all over the place until I realized this was the invisible question that I didn't even have a name for. And then a parent in a parenting class actually asked it to me. She said, how can I give my kids a normal childhood? I didn't have a normal childhood. And I realized, oh yeah, that's my question too. So now I'm writing that book.
Wonderful. Congratulations. I'm looking forward to reading it.
Thank you.
I'm here on social media to be descriptive, not prescriptive. I'm here to educate, inform, and hopefully entertain, but never to treat. If listening to this podcast helps you realize that you need therapy, I am all for that. But podcasts aren't therapy. Please reach out to a mental health professional licensed in your jurisdiction. You'll be glad you did. Wish post-traumatic parenting was a talk show, not a podcast? Do you have a question for me or for my guests? Great news! You can ask those questions by following me on Instagram. My handle is at Dr. Kozlowitz Psychology. It's also in the show notes. I love it when people reach out, DM, or post a question. Who knows? Your question might spark an entire episode. Come join our community. We get it. We're post-traumatic parents too. Can't wait to hear from you.